Accession number 5202, Reel 3.
Mr. Salmon, Reel 3. Did the outbreak of the European war have any effect on you professionally as soldiers in Hong Kong?
Oh yes, I would say not only the outbreak of war in 39, but from about 38 onwards it affected us. With the threat of war in Europe, we started to get some new equipment. We received some 3.7-inch anti-aircraft guns, and also we received some Bofa guns, which was equipment that we had never even heard of before.
And what about personnel? Did that increase?
To some extent it decreased. There's a lot of trained specialists anyway were sent home, I think, to act as a nucleus for the rapidly expanding services back in this country. I don't think at that time Hong Kong was very high on priorities, and of course the first thing that happened was the normal trooping season had been done away with, and we never knew when we were going to leave and when and how. Of course it threw everything completely haywire, especially as we were a little bit concerned about our families. And when war broke out in 39, of course we just had to sit tight and hope for the best.
Did you think that the war was going to pass you by in Hong Kong?
No, because from about 1938 onwards, the Japanese were really making some threatening noises out there. We had had a number of incidents up in Shanghai, and that where Westerners had been ill-treated by the Japanese. And we had... They'd already gone into Canton, and we knew then that the Japanese were likely to be a nuisance, at least in the next year or so. I think it's then that we started to get a little bit concerned about what was going to happen if the Japanese attacked, although we still never had a very great opinion of them. Because to us, we were an outpost, but we had the Gibraltar of the East, as we used to think of it, Singapore to our back, in which we could get all the reinforcements and all the navy and all the air force we wanted from there. It didn't turn out that way, but this is what we thought at the time.
In April 1939, you were transferred to Cape Dagula PWSS.
Yes, that's Port War Signal Station. The work that I've been doing on Blackhead Fort in the town, I was shifted out to the most easterly point of Hong Kong, a peninsula that used to stick out into the China Sea, and right at the end of it, in an old lighthouse, I was put to try and record, and if possible to sketch, Japanese aircraft that were operating that end of the island or just outside the limits, harbour limits. And this was quite an interesting period, because there was a lot of Japanese Navy craft up and down just outside territorial waters. In fact, they used to flaunt themselves going up and down just 6 to 10 miles off the coast. They used to launch their aircraft, and I used to do sketches of the squadron markings of the different Japanese aircraft and send it in to Fortress headquarters, but what used to happen to it then, I have no idea. P- footwar signal station was actually the station where which used to challenge. We had Navy signalers there that used to challenge all boats coming in, whether civilian or naval. And I used to do aircraft the same. There used to be the signal of the day, identification signal of the day, used to change every day. And, any aircraft coming in, we used to just signal it and interrogate it, and they should send back the identification signal. We used to do this. And this was the idea of Port Bore Signal Station, and the Navy people used to challenge all Navy craft coming in and civilian craft, and then we used to phone it through. So the, I mean, we were completely outside of the harbour, so this gave a good warning for the harbour authorities.
Did the Japanese planes ever used to buzz British installations?
No, never did. They never. They used to overfly occasionally, but at invariably at a good height. There was no point in them really, because they could get all the information they wanted in Hong Kong by their informers in Hong Kong. I mean, there was such a great population of Asiatics there that there was no problem as regards getting information. I mean, as I mentioned previously, quite a number of the local population used to be employed in the forts. How many of these used to pass on information? No idea, but they could give the Japanese all the information as regards equipment and that they wanted.
Was this form of Japanese intelligence gathering discussed amongst the troops at this time in 1939?
No, I don't think we knew it was going on. I don't think that we were all that bothered about it. As I say, we never really thought of the Japanese as being aggressors. We knew that they were probably going to be a nuisance. But don't forget, in those days we had Singapore to our back, and just 600 miles to the east we had the Philippines. We had all the weight of the Americans, and we thought, oh, you know, if they ever come into Hong Kong there, they get really pounced upon by the Americans from the east and our own people from the south.
Can you tell me what work you were involved in when you were transferred to the HKSRA?
HKSRA, the Hong Kong Singapore Royal Artillery, this was a regiment composed of Indian troops. It used to be invariably 50% Sikh and 50% what we used to call Musulman, or in day would be known as Muslim. And these regiments had usually commanded by British officers and British NCOs. And I was posted to the regimental headquarters, which was in Gun Club here in Kowloon, in their record office. I'd previously passed a trade test as an artillery clerk. The regiment in Hong Kong, they had one regiment in Singapore and one regiment in Hong Kong. The regiment in Hong Kong used to be partly mountain artillery and partly pack artillery.
What type of equipment would they have?
Medium. 4.5s, medium. 4.5s. The pack was the. Oh, now you were asking me. I think they were the about a 12-pounder. I think the pack, but I'm not absolutely certain on that. I didn't come into to a great extent in contact with the equipment there. But it was purely horse and mules equipment.
Why should they have wanted you as a record officer with this unit?
Because it, all the record, the Hong Kong Singapore Royal Artillery wasn't only for the mountain and the medium regiment at Gun Club Hill. The other coast defence regiments, the 5th AA regiment, Lai Moon, the one I come from, they, from about 1938 onwards, you asked me earlier about the whether we increased the troops. We did, but from India. And we formed extra sections or batteries of what we used to call HKSRA, but they were attached to the 5th AA regiment. So 5th AA regiment had, say, a battery of HKSRA troops, which are purely Indian. They had their own Indian officers and that, although they were commanded by British officers. The Coast Defence Regiment, the 20th Coast and 8th Coast Regiment, they each had HKSRA working with them. In other words, to make up the numbers, they had these people. So in Hong Kong alone, there was a tremendous amount of these HKSRA people. And we had a records office, or a records office was developed in Gun Club Hill, because we had to work out all the pay for these people, which went back to their relatives in India. You see, they drew very little of their pay in Hong Kong, just what they, but the bulk of it, I think all Indian troops everywhere do the same thing. All this had to be remitted back. So there was a lot of communication between Hong Kong records and the records back in India. Whereas for the British side, you still had your record offices. You had your record offices back here. You have to have them where you've got troops concerned. But being a more or less localised regiment, we had the records there. In fact, after the war, I had to go back up to Ambala in India to help wind up the affairs of the HKSRA when it was disbanded. This was when we used to we had to go through every member of the HKSRA, and we had to grade them either black, white or grey, depending on whether they collaborated with the Japanese or not. And this was not only in Hong Kong, but in Singapore and Malaya as well.
How smooth was collaboration between the HKSRA and the British units?
They were completely separate to some extent. They were under their own Indian NCOs, their own Indian officers. Their Indian officers were under British officers, but all their orders, commands and everything like that used to be through their own particular people. And in each unit that had HKSRA, they used to have a religious leader too. This was very, very important.
You mean a mullah?
Yes. But not only for the Sikhs, but also for the Mohammedans as well.
So he was a religious man who used to take
services.
Oh, yes,
he used to do nothing else but that. There was pretty much of a riot. I'm not going to say a riot, how shall I say, a mutiny to some extent. It took place at one of the Coast Defence Regiment on Stonecutters Island, where the Sikhs refused to wear steel helmets. There was an order passed out that in the event of an air raid or that, steel helmets will be worn, and they wouldn't have it.
What date was this?
Oh, I think this was about 1939, 1940. Could be within 12 months of that. And I wouldn't say it's a mutiny, but they did take over a guard room, and there was about 20 senior Sikhs. Some sergeant majors, some with 20, 25 years service. And they refused to wear these steel helmets, and they had to bring special religious leaders out from India to sort it out. there was some court martials and a lot of them were dismissed and thus. But this was a case on more religious grounds, very similar to the controversy you had recently in England about the Sikhs wearing crash helmets, I think, on motorbikes. This was what we had out there, but regarding steel helmets. I think that they eventually come to the decision that the order will be given for them to wear steel helmets, and it was up to them whether they did or not. At that time, India was very touchy, and I think the idea was to try and smooth it over as much as possible. There was quite a few court martials and quite a few senior Sikhs that got court martial. I mention this only from the point of view of just to show you how careful you had to be in dealing with these particular people, because we used to send recruiting, or the HKSRA used to send recruiting teams to India, up into the Punjab, or to recruit, and they used to come out to I don't think they ever went through a school in India. I think they come straight out, and they went through all their training out in Hong Kong. So these were people right from isolated villages that had never even seen the next village, suddenly transported right across to the Far East and then put into a uniform. And unless you had leaders or that and people to tell them what to do, it's extremely difficult.
Was a show of force used to on the occasion of this refusal to wear steel helmets?
I wasn't there at the time, so I can't say. But yes, from what I know, yes, they brought other units in, and it was touch and go for a while. I think they were just trying to make the point, but they did take over a guard room.
Did any firing take place?
No.
How long did the incident last for?
I think probably 2 or 3 days, I think. I think it'd been building up for a little while.
Were there any other problems, or was it just the issue of steel helmets?
It was only steel helmets.
What impression did you form of the efficiency of this unit, the HKSRA?
Well, perhaps I can sum up better by saying that during the Battle of Hong Kong, although it didn't last any length of time, there was a number of units that that was under their own officers that did extremely well, and there was other units that had done extremely bad. So a lot depended on the individual that led them, I would think. No, I think they were the same as any other troops. If they were well led, they were quite good, and if they were badly led, the Japs treated them very badly afterwards, or whenever they captured them. I remember when we walked or marched after the Japanese had captured Hong Kong, we were marching down to a prisoner of war camp. And just by Lai Moon, the whole hillside was covered with them, with their, you know, where they'd been killed, with their hands tied behind their backs. The whole hillside was covered with them.
From this particular
30,
unit?
40 bullets, yes, all Indian troops, yeah. So,
why do you think the Japanese should have singled them out?
I don't know. It's very, very hard to understand the Japanese mentality. they used to laugh at you 1 minute and shoot you the next. Something hard to explain why they did these things. I think a lot depended on the officer in charge as regards how they treated any prisoners they took. The other thing to realise from their point of view, perhaps something in their favour, is the fact that when they stormed ashore in Hong Kong, they were after get in as far as they can in the shortest possible time, through the hills, through all the fixed defences, go up, and they were in little parties. And they had no time to take prisoners. They never had the facilities to do it. So what are you going to do? You get 20 people surrounding, what are you going to do? Turn them loose? And the Japanese just shot them, and then they passed on. From the Asiatic point of view, this is the only thing they could have done.
Shortly before the Japanese attack, you were transferred to another unit. Can you tell me how that came about?
Yes, I'd just gone to the Hong Kong Singapore Royal Artillery for, I forget how long now, for a few months. Then they transferred the, because I think this is, 1941, just before the war broke out there, they shifted the records office for safety purposes back to Amballo in India. And one of the chaps, lucky one, went back with it. I wasn't so lucky. But of course, when they'd shipped the records back, then I was put to the 965 Defence Battery, the beach defence at Stanley, as their chief clerk.
Can you describe that unit?
Yes, it was had about. It was an independent battery with 2-pounder anti-tank guns and also 2 18-pounder field guns. The independent battery was composed of about 100 British officers and other ranks, and about 60 or 70 Hong Kong Singapore Royal Artillery personnel. This was Sikhs and Mohammedans. That when there was about the composure, just under 200, I think, the strength. And in the event of mobilisation, the beach defence guns will go to certain areas designated, and but being completely mobile, they were able to shift from place to place as they required. In fact, when the Japanese did attack, they started off by being right at the waterfront on the north side of the island, and they ended up right in the south side of the island. They weren't very big, just 2-pounder anti-tank guns, but they were useful.
Can we go on now to the Japanese attack, and could you describe for me in as much detail as possible exactly what you saw of it?
Yes. We got the message through, I think, about 3:15 on the 8th of December. The message was war with Japan is imminent, and about half an hour later we received the message that we are now at war with Japan. And by that time, we had already mobilised. Our guns had been out on beach defence positions for at least 3 days before that. I mean, there was a certain amount of warning that things were pretty pretty tight as regards the Japanese. And I don't think we were caught off foot as regards the attack. I think that everybody was in their mobilisation position when war did actually break out. The first we knew about it was an air raid on Kai Tak, air raid on Sham Shui Po, which was an empty barracks at that time, and on Stonecutters Island. They were the start, and from then onwards we had constant bombing. That time I was mainly in Stanley, although I went out to the beach defence units frequently. But headquarters was in Stanley, and we were just bombed and that until the 18th. Our positions. Do you want the positions?
Yes, please.
We had 2 pounder guns at Taikoo Dockyard, 2 2-pounder guns at Dockyard. We had 2 4-5s at Bremer. No, I'm sorry, not Bremer, Belcher's Fort. We had 4.5s at Bremer and 2 2-pounder guns at Sheko. I think that was 2 more 2-pounder guns at Waterfall Bay. That was our beach defence positions as at the outbreak of war with Japan. Our job was pretty static until after, at least while the fighting on the mainland took place, apart from air raids and towards the end a certain amount of shelling by Japanese Navy guns from the landward side, not from the actual boats. They used to bring up Navy guns along the in the new territories. But of course the Japanese attacked across from Kowloon to Hong Kong on the 18th, and then our problems started, and our guns gradually retreated. The Taikoo Dockyard retreated back to Taitam Reservoir. Our Sheko guns retreated back to Taitam Tuck. Our Bremer guns went to Wong Nai Chong. And in the next 2 days, of course, the situation was extremely fluid, and most of our guns were gradually pulling back all the time to the south side of the island. I went down to visit some of our positions the day before the Japanese attacked across the harbour, and that time the Japanese had the whole of Kowloon, and they were quick firing guns from the warehouses on the harbour front in Kowloon. They used to open the warehouse doors, fire their shots, and then close the doors again. The warehouse, we used to call them go-downs, they were shelling very severely Mount Davis and also Stonecutters Island. Stonecutters Island, which was coast defence installations on it, had been evacuated previously, but the Japanese still bombing it and shelling it. But they were